This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
That's the People Speak on BBS Radio for this week. I'd like to thank David Swanson for being my guest, and I'd like to close out with something I recorded at my son Casey's grave this past Memorial Day, which also happened to be his 38th birthday if he weren't killed in the illegal memorial war in Iraq. So please listen to this as we close out. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The People Speak. Peace out for now.
Welcome back to The People Speak with Cindy Sheehan. I'm obviously your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at BBS Radio, and it's usually live, but this week we are recorded, so please don't call in, because there'll be nobody there to talk to. So anyway, our guest today is my friend and one of the hardest working people in the peace movement, David Swanson, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with David and his work. David, welcome to The People Speak with Cindy Sheehan.
Hi, Cindy. Good to be here.
Well, thank you, David. In case there is somebody out there who is not familiar with you, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I've got a website at davidswanson.org with more about me than anyone could want to know, and I, like you, have been working in the peace movement in the U.S. And traveling elsewhere for years and years and years now, it seems, with some successes and some great defeats and failures, but some education of people done, and plenty of things to work on.
Well, I think our failure is not so much a failure, because we still have to, it's just that haven't been successful yet.
Well, that's right.
That's what I think.
we expect to accomplish things far more quickly than these things can usually be accomplished, and we have to work in terms of generations, not minutes or days or weeks, but we have to hurry, because the Earth's climate, the Earth's environment, the oceans, the land are being rapidly destroyed, and the proliferation of weapons and the threats and risks of nuclear apocalypse are growing. And so, you know, we actually have to succeed quickly if we want to preserve this planet.
You know, I think the race now is the U.S. going to blow up the world, or is the world just going to blow itself up first? I think that's a race right now.
Yeah, that's what we're looking at.
It's not funny, but, you know, it's just really ridiculous that that here in 2017 we're still facing that option.
Yeah, I was just over in Russia and discussing with a Russian friend the U.S. role as chief war maker, chief aggressor, chief threatening rogue state against Russia, and yet I had to point out to him, you know, you guys are number two in selling weapons to all these countries that don't make their own weapons but fight all these wars with U.S. and Russian weapons, and you, like the U.S., are a huge producer and promoter of the fossil fuels that are going to destroy the world just a little more slowly than a nuclear war kicked off by Washington. So, you know, pick your poison. Which way do you want to destroy the Earth? You know, make the Earth mammal free again, or whatever Donald Trump's real slogan is. But we've got to stop you know, we've got to reverse all of these trends with a movement that takes us to sustainable practices in terms of foreign policy and energy consumption, which of course can go together.
Well, I want to talk about your trip to Russia, but let's talk a little bit about, you did mention Donald Trump. You are one of the few people who remained active during the Obama administration. Talk a little bit about how frustrating it was to be involved during his 8 years of war and carnage.
Yeah, I think we are still suffering deeply from the damage that Barack Obama did to peace advocacy in the world, because he was fueled by partisanship, which, you know, runs so broad and deep in the United States, loyalty to the Democratic Party. And he went and gave a pro-war speech, accepting a Nobel Peace Prize, and he advocated for war after war after war for bogus humanitarian purposes and with the pretense of law enforcement as opposed to law destruction and criminal activity. And people fell for it. You know, and I always, you know, I knew for a fact and still believe that if it had been a Republican president in 2014 who had, 2012, who had come out and said, I go through a list of men, women, and children every week and pick who to murder with missiles from flying robots, you know, all hell would have broken loose. But I thought wrongly. That as soon as we replaced Obama with a Republican and people found out that a Republican was doing that with drones and doing everything else with wars that Obama had been doing, all hell would break loose. And no, in fact, you know, it's not all on Obama, but it's one big factor. The bad education, the bad media production, the bad communication system, the partisanship, the Obama effect, you know, has all built up over the years to create a situation now in which people just accept war across the political spectrum in the United States. Can't even, I speak at events and people can't even name all the places the United States is bombing, but they're in favor of or accepting, or in other cases, I'm speaking to peace advocates and they're against, but even they can't name them all.
Right.
You know, it's just become normal. Warfare has just become completely acceptable. And that, as much as the damage he did to climate negotiations, the damage he did in particular wars and so forth, it is what I fault Obama for most.
Right. You know, like we thought, I was with you. I thought the same thing. But Trump has not stopped any of the U.S. aggressions, and he's done some spectacular things like the so-called mother of all bombs in Afghanistan, bombing a Syrian airfield. And not only did people not protest, they started to call him presidential now. Now he's looking like a president.
Yeah, well, people is a little bit broad. You mean talking heads on the corporate media primarily.
Primarily, but that's where most, unfortunately, of our citizens get their information.
Yes, and many, many people accept it and repeat it and parrot what they hear, but that's where it starts. And so that's where I like to lay a significant bit of the blame. But, you know, this is what the media and the U.S. public do with Donald Trump. If he bombs someplace, they give him love and praise. If he misspells some tweet, they ignore and distract from his crimes for a week. If there's a way to hold him accountable, they say, oh, no, let's not get radical. Let's not impeach him. Let's just whimper a little more loudly. You know, let's back some gun nut for Congress who happens to be a Democrat. And if there's a way to go after and tear down the one possible silver lining in his presidency, you know, his hesitancy for whatever crazy reasons to be sufficiently hostile toward the other big nuclear armed government on Earth. And if there's a way to create a case against him that will collapse for lack of evidence and that people don't really care about because it doesn't really impact them and nobody's seen any actual evidence for it, well, let's go with that, you know, and meanwhile, let's attack the real journalists and the actual whistleblowers. I mean, this is the approach of the U.S. media and the Democratic Party, and many of those, you know, current heroes of progressives in the United States, the employees of the CIA and the FBI. This is the approach they take to having put a fascist in the White House. This is not what you do when you put a fascist in the White House. You go out and refuse to cooperate in any way. You demand his removal and all of his supporters' removal from Washington, and you insist on a completely different approach to the world and with the world.
Right, and you said just whine a little bit more about what Trump's doing. At least Nancy Pelosi, who is the House Minority Leader, at least she's consistent in consistently not wanting to hold war criminal presidents accountable.
She's a disaster. The Democratic Party is a disaster. I have always been told you must work through elections. Elections are the real answer. But, you know, looking back at decades of activism, elections have never been the major part of improving anything. Nonviolent activism and education and organizing and protest and resistance have been the major forces that have in some cases been followed up by elections and worked with elections. But, you know, and I always say I'm not against elections. I'd like to have one someday, but right. We haven't had one in recent decades. We now have one. Next week we have one, but it's across the ocean. You know, it's our friend Jeremy Corbyn, an actual peace activist, an actual advocate for popular proposals, who could be made prime minister of the chief co-conspirator in U.S. crimes around the world. And that would do more good for the world than had either of the candidates won in any of the recent U.S. presidential elections.
Well, right. And you said that Russia was a major arms dealer, but so is Great Britain, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, the big six are the five permanent members of the UN Security Council. That is the U.S., Russia, Great Britain, China, France, and then you have to add Germany in there. By some measures in recent years, Russia has topped the U.S., but pretty consistently and in some ways dramatically, the U.S. has stayed at number one. But, you know, the other big ones are England, France, and Germany, plus China and Russia. And the seventh place is, you know, not anywhere within sight. And most of the world makes virtually no weapons of war whatsoever. And almost none of the places other than Israel that are involved in any of the major wars manufacture any weapons to speak of. You know, it's these wealthy NATO nations plus Russia and China pushing these deadly products on these poor places that we then turn around and think of as backward and violent because they're killing each other so much, while they've been armed and trained and pushed and helped in killing each other by the policies of the U.S. government and in many cases European governments as well. And that would not be the policy if Jeremy Corbyn were prime minister.
Right. Thank you. I did read your piece you just wrote, and I like that line. You're not against elections. You think we should have one of these days. That would be great. Speaking of something that's normalized, I think that it's just accepted wisdom, and I put wisdom in air quotes, it's just an accepted fact, and I put fact in air quotes, that Russia hacked U.S. elections in 2016. Nobody is even, I don't want to say nobody, very few people are questioning that. Very few people are saying, where's the proof, blah, blah, blah. And the reason I invited you to be on this show is because you recently went to Russia. And, you know, there's just so much propaganda. So it's almost like back in the 60s when I was growing up, the Russophobia, the red baiting, when there's not even any reds to speak of, is just profound. And of course, Hillary Clinton is blaming everybody except her milkman for why she lost in 2016. What did you find when you went there, David?
Well, I found a wealthy Western European capitalist country, very friendly, very open. The signs in Russian and English, a place that most U.S. tourists would love to go. Did they have the nerve to go there? I went to Moscow, you know, the biggest and one of the most beautiful cities in Europe, and met a lot of people, ordinary random people and very important people and former heads of the country like Mikhail Gorbachev and journalists and academics and entrepreneurs and so forth, and got a variety of opinions, but a lot of agreement among them. You know, they are, you know, still able to some diminished extent to distinguish the U.S. government's actions from the U.S. public, and they love U.S. culture and they love European culture. And it's, you know, as a distant second choice that their government is aligning with China, you know, because they wanted to join NATO and were told to go to hell. They wanted to join the European Union before that and were told to go to hell. They've tried disarmament. They've tried cooperation and have been told, no, you are a permanent enemy. And they find the story that you mentioned about Russia hacking the U.S. election laughable. And they find what the United States has been told about Russia and Russian actions in Ukraine and what's happened in Ukraine and similar stories and in Syria almost unbelievable. And they haven't heard them before. You tell them what it is that people in the United States have been told have happened in these places. I think it would do people in the United States a great deal of good to visit with some Russians, visit with some of the people. We had 30 people on this trip, and they're all back, and most of them willing to come speak publicly around the United States. Listen to them. Invite some Russian friends to come to the United States. Listen to them. There are many, many criticisms of Vladimir Putin and great opposition to Vladimir Putin in Russia, but many people will tell you they have ceased criticizing him and will go back to it only when the sanctions have been lifted, that right. They are uniting against their common threat, you know, the threat that's put missiles on their borders aimed at them and sanctions on their economy.
Isn't that interesting? We've seen sanctions put in place by the U.S. and many countries, and the so-called rationale for that is to have the people rise up against the leadership, where most of the time, if not all the time, it has the exact opposite effect.
Yeah, predictably enough, you know, it's not as if you need a PhD in this stuff to recognize that this is typical, that this is what predictably has happened in Iran, what predictably has happened in Russia. I mean, you and I and everyone used to joke, you know, over a decade ago now that, you know, Bush could have asked a historian what happens when you bomb a country and, mm-hmm. and invade and occupy it, do they welcome you as heroes with flowers and chocolate or not? You know, it might have been useful to ask someone who had read any account of any time it had ever been done. Well, the same could be said of Barack Obama, who, you know, puts himself across as some sort of former constitutional law professor, liberal academic. But who did he ask before putting sanctions on Russia whether it would cause Russians to throw out their president? He didn't ask you or me. You know, I mean, right. this is a guy who asked the CIA, has it ever worked to arm proxy armies to overthrow a government like Syria's? And the CIA actually produced a report that said, well, nope. Hasn't. Here's a long list of failures. Closest thing to a success they pointed to was Afghanistan Mujahideen, which, you know, as people may be familiar with, had a little bit of blowback. And so what did Obama do? He went ahead and, you know, armed and trained fighters in Syria, never mind that he had gotten a report on whether it ever works and been told, no, it doesn't. I mean, this is the difference. With Trump, he doesn't bother to get the report. You know, right. He just goes ahead and does it. Who cares? I'm not so stupid as to care whether it's ever worked or not before. Obama would care, but then he wouldn't act on it. So, you know, it's not a big difference if you're one of the people being bombed.
Well, you know, if your business is selling arms and you're not going to, you know, create peace, if your business is selling arms, if your business is selling cars, you're not going to sell a car that's going to last 100 years, right?
That's right.
So you have to create this chaos. You have to create these wars. And it's interesting that you mentioned Ukraine, that there's absolutely, I haven't found any credible proof that that Russia hacked U.S. elections, but there is a lot of proof that the U.S. was involved in the overthrow of a legitimate Ukrainian government to install some elements of neo-Nazism.
Not just evidence, but public admission before, during, and after the coup. Right. I mean, phone calls exposed and made public and big news stories prior to the coup, and it didn't make any difference. And you see this violent coup facilitated with U.S. support, a handpicked U.S. puppet put in power, as had been publicly foreshadowed by information we had before it was done, and a government put in with literal Nazis as part of it that begins making noises about banning the Russian language and so forth. And what do the people in Crimea do? Under absolutely no military threat from Russia, they vote overwhelmingly to rejoin Russia. Which Crimea had been part of, which, you know, the people speak Russian. They have the same church as the Russians. They had been part of Russia until they'd been transferred by Khrushchev to Ukraine, when it was a transfer from the Soviet Union to the Soviet Union that nobody noticed or cared about. And what is the story we're told back in the United States? That Russia has attacked and invaded and seized Crimea and forced its people to join Russia. And you go the previous trip last year that this U.S. group took, people went to Crimea and tried to find a single person who believed that, tried to find anyone who had seen any military intimidation or anything of the sort, couldn't find one, tried to find a single person who would rejoin Ukraine if they could. Couldn't find one, you know, and I couldn't find anyone in Russia, you know, other than, I mean, any ordinary Russians on the street or students in the schools who had even heard the story that we've been told in the United States about what happened in Crimea. And when they were told it, you know, they found it unbelievable.
Laughable, yeah. So when you, 'cause you also went to Cuba, I think, recently. And I know when I go to those countries and I come back and I report what I saw, I get a lot of, well, you know, Cindy, you only saw what you were allowed to see. You didn't see the real picture. How do you feel about your trip to Russia? Do you feel like you were under some control, tightly controlled group that got some kind of, mythological view of Russia?
No, and you're right that you get those responses and you get demands who paid for the trip, mm-hmm. Who oversaw you and so forth. I mean, it's true that in Cuba, in both cases, we had to get a visa before we could go. And in Cuba, we had a state, tour service. But when we weren't on the tour, we could go wherever the heck we wanted and talk to whoever we felt like talking to about anything. Even the tour guides and anybody we met with were perfectly free and open about criticizing the Cuban government. Mm-hmm. And when we went to Russia, we went out and found our own tour guides and made our own friends and went wherever the heck we wanted and met with dissidents and opponents and, anti-Putin journalists and whoever we felt like meeting with. I met a friend from New Zealand, an activist who's fled New Zealand after the Occupy movement because of how nasty their police were, who's living in Moscow. And she had a friend in Moscow who was a tour guide and showed us around. But then we also had a sort of an official tour guide prearranged who took us on a bus. This is a private company. It's not the Russian government. But both of them and other people showing tourists around at the big tourist sites, the Kremlin and St. Basil's Cathedral and so forth. I mean, they're denouncing and joking about how awful the Russian government is right in front of the Russian government, pointing out the tour guide, the official tour guide is pointing out to us where an opponent of Putin's was murdered on a bridge and denouncing the failure of the justice system to pursue the case and so forth, literally 100 feet from the Kremlin. And I'm thinking, my God, I have never once seen a tour bus or a tour guide of any sort in Washington, D.C. point out things to be regretted or make any jokes or, there's the monuments of the slave owners or here's the monuments glorifying wars on Vietnam and Korea. And, how many tours have you seen go to the Watergate and say, here's where, there right. was a break-in to sabotage an election? I mean, none of it. If comparing the free speech and the willingness to speak out against a government, is far more present in Moscow than in Washington. There's a similar problem in terms of media, right? In the United States, you have the big corporate media outlets that all have pretty much the same voice and never challenge anything and have most of the viewers and most of the readers. And in the smaller media outlets, you can say whatever the heck you want. In Russia, they have a handful of state television channels that say what the state wants said, just like what the corporations want said. And then you have all the smaller media outlets that say whatever the heck they want. It's a very similar problem, but we think of it as being dramatically different, as somehow being worse in Russia than in the United States.
Well, you weren't on the Spring Rising bus tour because we did exactly what you just said you'd never see people doing. That was
true.
Different. That was a little different. So I do want to get to what's happening here in the States, in the belly of the beast, in the major. I think there was recently, this past week, some events in Washington, D.C. that Veterans for Peace were involved in, but we have a few minutes. Is it before the break? Is there anything you'd like to say about your Russian trip before we take a quick break and get into what's happening here?
Well, just to reemphasize that the central story that Russia hacked, whatever that means, the U.S. election, has no evidence. And I am absolutely certain if there were any evidence, we would have seen it by now. And people are taking that word to mean that the Russian government somehow broke into election machines or ballot counting and so forth. Nobody has even claimed such nonsense. The central claim is that the Russian government informed the U.S. public by leaking Democratic Party emails what the Democratic Party was up to, namely that it was sabotaging its own strongest candidate, which would have been a favor to the U.S. public, good information on what our election system was, and we ought to thank Russia, but Russia didn't have anything to do with it. And so we're getting all these sort of tangentially related stories about Trump officials who've had some sort of contact with Russia, or a guy who worked for someone in the White House whose cousin once met a Russian, and so forth. And, you know, a lot of these are absolute nonsense, and they're legal, moral actions denounced as crimes. Others may very well be crimes, but they have nothing to do with Russia hacking the U.S. election. And so we should stop. It's just constantly referred to, the Russian interference in the U.S. election, as if it's been established as fact, right. in countless articles that say nothing about it whatsoever, just refer to it as established fact. It is not anything of the sort.
Well, and it's amazing that some people who are probably Democrats against Trump are making common cause with the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, James Comey now, who was the bad guy before the election. Now he's a good guy. It's just amazing that they're saying, well, you know, would the CIA lie about this? Well, of course the CIA would lie about it. They lie about just about everything. Well, anyway, yeah. We're speaking to David Swanson. You're listening to The People Speak with Cindy Sheehan. Excuse me, I can't even say my own name right. Cindy Sheehan on BBS Radio. Stay tuned for this short break. Okay, you're back with The People Speak with Cindy Sheehan. We're talking to our guest, David Swanson. David, I mentioned a little bit before the break about the recent events in Washington, D.C. On Memorial Day or around Memorial Day, you participated in, correct?
Yeah, Veterans for Peace organized a sort of alternative Memorial Day, and someone during it actually proposed that this become a standard practice the day after the so-called Memorial Day to have an alternative Memorial Day. The idea being, if you talk about war, mourn all the victims and regret the wars and talk about how to get beyond war. You know, we used to have holidays celebrating the ends of wars as a positive development in promoting peace and world advocacy for peace. I mean, this was Armistice Day before it became Veterans Day, and even to some extent Decoration Day before it became Memorial Day. And this is, you know, now we have some 100 or so pro-war military holidays, days and weeks and months, you know, throughout the year, everything from, you know, Military Spouse Appreciation Day to, you know, Flag Day and Victory Day. And there was even an Iraq-Afghanistan Wars holiday created by Congress that I think most people have managed to ignore. But we had a terrific event in front of the Lincoln Memorial on the day after Memorial Day, organized by Veterans for Peace, with lots of great speakers and a member of Veterans for Peace who brought a bell tower that's been at a lot of events that looked really beautiful by the Lincoln Memorial. That's made out of recycling soda cans and has messages mourning all of the dead of all of the wars, and a bell inside that you ring. And And then there was a march to the White House and a protest in front of the White House. And I would like to see, and I was privileged to give some short remarks at this occasion, and I spoke about the problem of war monuments being everywhere and peace monuments being so few and far between. But I hope such events occur in more places for more years.
Oh, well, what do you think? What's coming up, David? What's coming up in the United States? What can we do to, what's for the climate march? I actually went to Washington, D.C. for the climate march, and there peace was mentioned one time. It was in one little module. They had different modules of the march, and I was told that they don't really want to muddy the message by talking about the Pentagon, by talking about how war is a major destroyer of the environment. But they had like 20 different things they were talking about. How really is LGBTQ issues more relevant? And I'm not saying they're not irrelevant issues. How are they more relevant to the climate than the Pentagon and war is?
Yeah, well, you know, there was actually something of a success in terms of that particular march in getting the big environmental groups that were behind it to do more, in relative terms, more in terms of speaking against war than they had ever done before. But it was a very, very small success, as is highlighted by the fact that you didn't notice it, and many people didn't notice it. And why would they have? You know, what we managed to accomplish was to get them to include peace as part of the agenda on their website, and peace advocates as one of the many different, you know, groups lining up in different places for the march. And so we actually had a peace rally with numerous speakers and a little, you know, PA system talking about peace and talking about the connections between militarism and environmental destruction at the beginning of the march, in one section of the march in the middle of the street. But if you were in a different section of the march, if you were lined up with the young people or the religious people or the, you know, the labor unions or whatever, then you totally missed that. And the rally at the very end of the march was a completely different affair. So, you know, baby steps, but there is a long, long way to go in terms of getting environmental groups to be willing to even speak against the biggest destroyer of the natural environment that there is, militarism and war. The U.S. military having created the vast majority of the Superfund environmental disaster sites, being the biggest consumer of petroleum we have, being the third leading polluter of U.S. waterways, and on and on. And they won't touch it. So there's work to be done there. And it can be done, you know, best at the local level. You know, your local Sierra Club is absolutely willing, the minute you ask, in most cases, to oppose war and make these connections. It's a question of building that pressure up to the national level in these environmental groups. There also is a big push now to stop this giant arms sale to Saudi Arabia that I think is very worth pursuing and has a chance of some success, at least partial, you know, despite the gross hypocrisy that, you know, the United States shouldn't sell weapons to somebody who kills civilians, as if the United States military isn't killing civilians by the thousands. But, you know, anything that will stop that and help possibly save millions of lives that are on the edge of starvation in Yemen has to be pursued. And so World Beyond War, which is a group I'm working with the most on these issues, is working on both of those and planning some other big events coming up this year that you can find on the events page of the World Beyond War site.
Well, talk about this terrible situation in Yemen that just really is like the least known, you know, U.S. disaster.
Yeah, and it's incredible that if it were not a war that had caused the famine, if there were just millions of people on the edge of starving to death and tens of thousands already having starved to death for some reason that could be blamed on a natural occurrence or an enemy of the U.S. government, it would be a major story. There's no way that it wouldn't. Millions of innocent children about to die for lack of food. But because it's a war. And there have been exceptions. You know, several weeks back, there was a big front page story in The Washington Post admitting that none of these wars in the Middle East, none of these famines in the Middle East and Northeast Africa would be happening without the wars that had created and were sustaining them. But these are exceptions. It's not a sustained narrative in the U.S. media. This is, a situation where, again, I had some hope that maybe we could build a movement against starving people to death, even if it had to also be a movement against war. But, it's turned out thus far that because it's war, we have to ignore or allow people to starve to death. And so you'll recall that Yemen was declared a successful drone war by Barack Obama, and that right. when we opposed, sorry?
I said right.
Yeah, and we would oppose this, and people would say, "Well, don't you prefer a drone war to some other kind of war?"
Right.
And I said, "Well, there wasn't any kind of war before. You've exchanged the absence of war for a drone war." And we had, young people from Yemen actually testifying in congressional hearings. You are creating terrorism. You are creating instability. You are doing more for criminals in Yemen than Yemenis ever could have done on their own. And nobody listened. And the predicted and expected disaster came, not exclusively because of the U.S. drone war, but in great part. And now Saudi Arabia is destroying Yemen with U.S. planes, U.S. bombs, U.S. refueling, U.S. targeting, weapons sold by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and President Obama, and now new sales being promised by President Donald Trump. And the one port where food is getting into Yemen is under threat of being completely destroyed by the United States or Saudi or its Gulf allies. And how is that not a bigger story than Trump misspelling a word?
Right.
How is an iceberg the size of a small state breaking off not a bigger story than Trump misspelling a word? This is the state of our communication system.
Well, you're right. I think if it was a famine that wasn't caused by war, you'd have all of the, neoliberal rock stars making a record about it.
Yeah, and I actually had some hopes that that would happen anyway, mm-hmm. that even though it was so clearly a war and a U.S. war that had caused this famine, that somehow people would be willing to oppose it because it was opposing starvation and opposing a war that was chiefly the work of the Saudi royal despots. But thus far, no. I mean, there is hope in Congress to stop some of these weapon sales, but it's going to take a lot of work. People are going to have to really push for it. This is what people don't realize about war. A lot of us get into opposing war because it's so directly and intentionally murderous.
Right.
But most of the murders are indirect. Most of the murders are because of the starvation or the deprivation or the disease, the crises that result from the wars, and because of the trade-off of what all the money going into the wars is not being used to do. This is where the vast majority of the death and destruction comes from.
Yeah, and you mentioned drone bombing. Back in 2010, I think, early 2010, I organized a protest in front of the CIA against drone bombing, and you should have seen it. Well, you can imagine, but the response I got was like, "Cindy, what are you, stupid? If we use drones in Iraq, your son would still be alive."
Yeah, I remember you getting those comments, and I got similarly stupid comments. You know, aren't drones better than other warfare? As if you must have some kind of warfare. And this is people have been sold, you know, in Hollywood movies like Eye in the Sky is sold people this package of lies that drone murders are somehow law enforcement rather than, you know, law breaking, and people believe it. And people believe there's some sort of moral dilemma and they have to be careful to kill the right people, but they're brave enough to take that on and even suffer PTSD for the greater human good, you know, because they take on this deeply troubling, necessary work. And it's all a package of lies. You know, I asked the director and the army general sitting next to him who consulted on the thing whether this movie, Eye in the Sky, resembled reality in any way. You know, whether there had ever been an actual drone murder in which any of the criteria had been met, or you'd identified the targets, they were an actual threat to someone, never mind an actual threat to the United States of America, as Obama claimed, that you couldn't arrest them for some bizarre reason, you had to kill them, and on and on. And they admitted no, not a single one of these criteria, as far as they knew, had ever been met in any real world drone murder, but it made for a good, thoughtful consideration of the ethics of it in the movie. Yeah, but the movie didn't come with a you know, warning, this is BS. You know, it's presented as if this is what's actually happening.
Well, you're brave to go to those movies, David. Anyway, we just have a few minutes left. Do you want to give your websites again or the main website?
Well, a good one for these topics is World Beyond War at worldbeyondwar.org, and we've got news updated there every day and videos and resources for events and how you can start a chapter and big events coming up this summer and this fall that people should be putting on their calendars. So please go there and sign your name if you haven't. That, you know, join people in 153 countries so far who have said they want to end all war and help make it happen.
Well, David Swanson, thank you for your work and thank you for giving your time to be on the People Speak this evening.
Thank you, Cindy.
Well, talk to you soon, I hope, and see you soon, I hope.
I hope so.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Come, you masters of war.
Hi, this is Cindy Sheehan. I've been a peace activist since 2004 when my son Casey was killed in Iraq. I've learned since then that achieving peace means more than just being anti-war. It encompasses being pro-environment and pro-equality for all people of all genders, religion, and ethnicities. Please join me at cindysheehansoapbox.blogspot.com with many other people who believe in working for a more peaceful and humane future.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing?
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Well, here it is, Casey's grave. On today, his birthday and Memorial Day. And like I said in a piece I wrote called For Our Freedom and Other Stuff, this cemetery in Vacaville hosts a Memorial Day event every Memorial Day. And the first Memorial Day after Casey was killed, which would have been almost 2 months after, I was an honored guest at that commemoration. And ever since I started speaking out against the wars and against the U.S. government, I haven't been invited back. Well, apparently today there was one where Casey's father, my ex-husband, was invited to speak. And my children and grandchildren all went. And of course, I didn't know about it. I probably wouldn't have gone even if I did know about it, because I commemorate Casey's sacrifice in other ways besides actually going to things or supporting things that glorify war and glorify these sacrifices as something holy instead of something unholy, and instead of something that is evil, unnecessary, illegitimate, immoral. These wars that our young people fight in and kill other people and get killed themselves are nothing but for profit. As Medley Butler said back in the 30s, the 1930s, war is a racket. It's perhaps the oldest and most profitable racket. And that's why they continue, and that's why our young people are force-fed this load of nationalistic bullshit. And so, of course, I wasn't invited to the thing that commemorated my son, and on his birthday, again, I wouldn't have gone anyway, but my oldest granddaughter came to my house afterwards, she's 7, and she said, "Gigi, why weren't you there?" My grandkids call me Gigi. And I said, "Why wasn't I where, honey?" And she said, "At the cemetery, Pop gave a speech about Uncle Casey." And Pop is my ex-husband, their grandpa. And she goes, "Did you have to work?" I said, "No, honey, I didn't know about it, for one thing. And secondly, I don't go to those things that make war look glamorous and good." And she said to me, "If war is so bad, why did Uncle Casey go?" And, of course, that's the question of the ages. Our young people are not given very many choices or opportunities. Casey wanted college money, and I explained that to her, and she said, "Well, I'm never going to go to war, and I'd rather not have money or go to college than to go to war." And obviously, that was a good answer, and that's the answer that we need to give, is that until these wars are made unprofitable, until capitalism is crushed in this country, until the two-party system is totally abolished and made irrelevant, the war party of the Democrats and Republicans will keep sending our young people to fight and die in their wars for profit. It's unconscionable and unacceptable. And I'm here because it's Casey's birthday. I don't come as often as I used to. I used to come every day. It was a good place for me to collect my thoughts and to meditate when he was first killed. Now I know that he's not here. His bones are here. And I know that his spirit, I will carry his spirit on in trying to work for an end to the empire that killed him, an end to war profiteering, an end to capitalism, which is such a diseased system of repression, oppression, war, where the, it's been said so often, the rich profit and the poor die for their profit. Very few benefit from war. And these gross displays of nationalism, the flag, the bloody rag of empire. Somebody put another flag on his grave. After I'm done videotaping, I'll remove the flags. This is my son. I don't give permission for them to put these gross nationalistic displays of U.S. imperial adventurism. I don't give them permission to put them on my son's grave. And I have said this over and over. Right here used to be a sticker that indicated that Casey is a veteran, which he never was a veteran. Veterans are people who leave service. Casey was killed in action during a war. Casey's not a veteran. To set the record straight, Casey didn't support the wars. He didn't want to kill anybody, but that's not an option or a choice that our troops can make. At least Casey resisted the brainwashing of thinking the people of Iraq were his enemy. It's been over 13 years since he was killed, and I can sit here and talk without breaking down in tears, but it's very hard. And I just want all the young people in our country to know to join the resistance against this empire. Support people in other countries who are actively resisting active bombings and occupations by the United States of America. Young people, join that resistance. Being a soldier doesn't pay very well. And if you live long enough, it certainly is hard to obtain any of the benefits that they promise you. And those benefits aren't that great anyway. So, like my granddaughter said, she'd rather not have money than go to a war. And I'd rather have Casey sitting on my couch for the rest of his life playing Xbox than actually thinking that he had a future, where he had opportunities, where he could get a good job, go to college without going into debt for the rest of his life, get a good, meaningful job with good pay and good benefits, raise a family in a peaceful country. That was Casey's only crime. He thought he could have more than his working class station in life offered him here in this terrible empire.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me. One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.